Wah bam bloom bam blam bam bam.
From WBEZ Chicago and PRX, this is Sound Opinions. I'm Jim DeRogatis.
And I'm Greg Kot. Electronic artist Moby lived through the gritty exuberance of underground rave culture as well as the decadence of mainstream success.
It felt like bizarre, almost psychedelic magical alchemy. You know, that I had combined some old drum machines and synths and old vocals and somehow created this bizarre pop culture phenomenon.
Moby joins us for a conversation about his first memoir, Porcelain. Then we review the new album from hip-hop jazz group Intellectual. That's all coming up on Sound Opinions.
You're listening to Sound Opinions, and that's Porcelain by our guest this week, Moby. That song comes from his 1999 album, Play, which was a huge breakthrough album for Moby in reaching a mainstream audience. It was an unprecedented success for an electronic artist at the time, and it helped make Moby the public face of techno for many listeners.
Porcelain is also the title of Moby's first memoir. The second volume, Then It Fell Apart, is due out next month. We spoke with Moby in 2016 when Porcelain was published. It documents his time coming up in the house scene until just before Play was recorded. To me, Porcelain ranks up there, Greg, right next to Beneath the Underdog by Charles Mingus as one of the best music autobiographies ever written. So we were very excited to welcome Moby to the studio. This book is blowing both of our minds.
Oh, thanks.
What an accomplishment. Congratulations. Why, Moby, write a book?
A good question, because when I was growing up, I assumed that the only people who write memoirs or autobiographies were like the very old, the very accomplished, or reality TV stars. If I was just thinking of writing about myself, I didn't think it was going to be that interesting. But I wanted to write about New York in the late 80s into the early 90s, about the rave scene, the early New York club scene, about sobriety and then the lack of sobriety. So that was what led me to want to write this, where it's like trying to like shoehorn all these different ostensibly disparate things into one book. So it's like me, New York, the weirdness of watching New York go from being this like crack damaged, gang riddled, AIDS destroyed place to being, you know, the gentrified New York of Mayor Giuliani.
That no one could afford to live in.
Yeah. And as a young kid, early 20s guy living in New York on practically no money, it was one of the most exciting times of your life, it sounds like.
It was. On the surface of it, like New York in 1989 was the worst place on the planet.
It was dangerous.
I mean, super dangerous and filthy, and you took your life in your hands doing anything. And like I remember a friend had all these locks on his door to keep the crack addicts out, and the crack addicts were very like motivated and rational. They just cut a huge hole in the wall next to his door to bypass
the
locks.
Door, yeah.
So it was this gang destroyed, rotten place, and I was so happy there. I think part of it is just a function of youth. Like what I've learned, and maybe this is a very self-evident thing to say, is as I get older and I become nostalgic for the past, partially it's a past that doesn't exist anymore, and partially it's just nostalgic for not being old. Hmm. You know, had we been 22 in a suburb of Dayton, we'd probably be waxing nostalgic about what Dayton was like in 1989.
So you're really an outsider in New York. You're an outsider because you're sober, you're Christian, you're vegan. I mean, you didn't fit in any way, shape, or form anywhere, but especially New York.
And that was one of the things that was so magical for me is here I was, this straight Caucasian, vegan, sober Christian DJing in clubs that were gay, African-American, and Latino, and filled with every drug that had ever been invented. Yeah. And it felt like I felt so honored that they let me in, because I had grown up, in a very sort of ostensibly banal Caucasian Connecticut, nice alliteration there,
yeah,
environment. And then suddenly, just by going a few miles west, I found myself in this urban environment where, and I was listening to music that came from traditions that I knew nothing about, whether it was hip hop or house music or dance music. And it was like being the most excited anthropologist or like cultural musical historian. And I got to be a part of it. By the mid 80s, a lot of white people music had become kind of anemic. Mm. Like I think of some of like the mumbly stuff coming out of England and some of like the guitar bands. Like they weren't bad, but it almost felt like they were too bored to care. You know, they're like, oh, like Pavement. Like I love Pavement, yeah, but like their whole ethos was like, well, we got nothing better to do. Might as well like detune our guitars and play songs.
Can you treat it like an oil well? When it's underground, out of sight. And if the sight is just a horse sign, can it make enough sense to me?
And then being in the hip-hop world in the mid to late 80s, or the house music world, especially house music, where it was like it was their answer to AIDS. It was their answer to these ruined urban environments. So as a result, it didn't feel elective. You know, it felt like this essential form of survival. Like, in order to be alive, they had to go into these nightclubs and reinvent themselves and reinvent their environments and not just exist in this AIDS-blasted urban environment. There was like an urgency and a beautiful like celebratory desperation that I felt in the 80s was missing from our white brethren's music world.
Rock and roll. Yeah.
Move the body and I rock notes like an instrument. Playing in the right pitch. Rock the left turntable then switch to the right. Is what I'm saying to the DJ playing. While the crowd is slaying, I keep rocking. I don't ruin the pace, set it off. Check 1-2 in the place, don't let up. And keep pumping. Got the groove, you ain't that something. So when the music's got your soul, yo, just let it roll, let it roll.
So you sign this little label called Instinct and start releasing singles that become anthems at the height of the first rave movement in 1990, 91, 92. In the book, you capture really well that sense of life and adventure and energy and exuberance. 2 years, and then it's kind of over, right? You know, much like the psychedelic moment of 67 and 68, you know, it's not long before darker drugs, darker moods, darker music comes in, and this idea that the universe is one, and, yeah, and there are no limits to the art or to ourselves, you know, it was like a flash and then it was gone.
It's kind of like a Pandora's box. Like you open it up and at first everything's beautiful and it so quickly turns dark. There's one part in the book where I talk about going to my favorite nightclub, and I hadn't been there in a while. It was called NASA. And I walk in and all of a sudden, like, the drugs had changed, the music had changed, and people were just like lying on the floor rather than dancing. Like no one was hugging each other anymore. They were just staring into space. And suddenly I realized it hadn't just happened. Like someone had actually curated the darkness. Mm. Like it was a choice. And it felt very off-putting to me because I wasn't doing these drugs. So like the darkness didn't make sense to me.
What's striking to me is that at that point, just a couple of years into your career, you already thought of yourself as a has-been.
I've been a has-been so many times. Like by 1993, like I was already kind of like a footnote from the rave era.
And you just had this massive club hit, Go, which was basically, you know, conceived by you in a bedroom, right, with very cheap equipment. And you were the talk of the town for 6 months, and then nobody cared a year later.
Yeah, and it was heartbreaking. First had a degree of success, I loved it, and I was very sad when it went away. But then it came back, and then it went away again, and then it came back, and then it went away again. So like over time, there's been a paradigm shift, And so now I basically just assume that the success is gone. Assume that my relevance ended a long time ago. So that way, if I have a degree of success or relevance, like, it's a pleasant surprise. When I was growing up, I really thought I was going to make music that no one would ever listen to. You know, my first punk rock band, the Vatican Commandos, we put out a 7-inch and it sold 200 copies. And I thought that was like unimaginable success. There are billions upon billions of pieces of music available for anyone to listen to at any point. For someone to take their time and make an effort to listen to something I've done, one person doing that is amazing. Mm. You know, and it's sort of unhealthy and kind of sick when a musician or any or a writer or anyone starts like depersonalizing a group of people and saying that, like, you only have legitimacy if you're reaching mass numbers of people. You know, you have legitimacy if you love what you're doing and if one person also loves what you're doing.
Sure.
You know, and anything more than that is just like a magical bonus.
But it seems like that period of not feeling relevant anymore freed you up to make a record where you're able to include just about everything that has ever interested you musically. In 1995, you put out the album Everything Is Wrong, which is musically, I mean, everywhere. Gospel, house, hardcore punk, ambient, you name it, it seemed to be in there. So I take Everything Is Wrong, Moby, as you saying, okay, I've got nothing to lose. I'm just going to make a record that I love, and maybe nobody else will love it.
I think it's a hybrid between like a lifeboat and the way a 3-year-old would make breakfast. You know, like where the 3-year-old's like, I like my Matchbox cars and I like Oreos and I like butter and I like the dog. So let's put that all in breakfast, you know, or yeah. The lifeboat thing of like, uh-oh, the flood's coming, throw the sink and the cat and my comic books and whatever into the lifeboat and see if it'll hold all of it. So that was kind of the ethos with the album, because I didn't think I'd ever be allowed to make an album. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know if I'd ever be allowed to make another album. So I just thought, like, why not see what I can shove into this record?
Well, and some people thought you were trying to assure that you wouldn't be able to make another album, like when you did Animal Rights. I don't remember your review, Greg, but I loved Animal Rights. Right? Hmm. You know, all of a sudden, the king of techno, the face of techno, remember when you were on every magazine briefly mm-hmm. as the face of techno, makes a tribute album to death metal, essentially, but with drum machines.
It's politely referred to as the career-killing album
yeah.
by my manager and the people who work for him.
Yeah.
This one moment I had in 1995, I was at a festival in Denmark and I was in the dance tent with, I think it was like Black Dog and LFO and Saint Etienne and a bunch of other very lovely, polite electronic musicians. There were maybe 10,000 people in there and no one was dancing. And then I walked to the main stage and I remember, I think it was Biohazard were playing and people were going nuts and people were dancing. And all of a sudden I realized, like, what's going on here? Like, all the energy is happening on the rock stage. And I just thought, oh, let me see what happens if I make a guitar-based record. Mm-hmm. There wasn't really much thought behind it. It was just the visceral satisfaction of playing electric guitar and yelling.
Played as if you were a member of Sepultura or Biohazard. You know, those poor keyboards would go flailing across the stage. Mm-hmm. You would end the show, you know, half naked, sweaty, exuberant, standing atop these keyboards.
Sometimes naked.
And just the energy level. You always played like that. And now we're in the era of what they call laptronica, somebody hitting mm-hmm. a button on a laptop. You always seem to want to put a show on.
Yeah, that, again, it just maybe it's what I grew up with, mm-hmm. but like I grew up seeing Bad Brains and Black Flag right. and Minor Threat and the Misfits, and like the bands would be sweaty and they'd be jumping around and the audiences would be sweaty and they'd be jumping around. And then when I first stood on stage as a solo performer, even though I was playing electronic music, it just made sense to jump around.
Yeah.
And maybe in my sort of quasi-solipsism, I didn't stop to notice that no one else was doing that. Sometimes I'd be at these raves and I would pay more attention to the audience. Mm-hmm. And the audience was like, you know, sweating and having the time of their lives. And you just sort of, you'd ignore the DJ. Yeah, the DJ yeah. would be standing there doing technical stuff. I'm like, oh, they're making the music. The audience is going crazy. But at least there was craziness going on.
People would just be outraged. Like, you know, you're putting your face on these magazine covers and you're, you know, you're totally against the culture of dance music where the DJ was kind of this anonymous shrouded figure. Nobody was supposed to know mm-hmm. who the DJs were. You're a sellout. You know, you're making $8,000 a year. You're a sellout, you yeah. know? And you didn't seem to care at all about any of that. It didn't seem to bother you.
I think a lot of DJs back then came from the world of DJing. You know, a lot of electronic musicians just came from the world of electronic music, and there was an anonymity there. But I came from the world of new wave and punk rock. So like if you made a record, you put your name on the cover of the record. And if you played a show, you jumped around on stage. And if you did an interview, you let someone take your picture. Mm. So to me, that just seemed like a natural function of being a musician who makes records. I didn't know there was some magical virtue in remaining anonymous.
You don't sort of wrap it up in a nice bow at the end. Like, oh, it all ended happily ever after. Your career is in disarray. You're making what you think will be your last recorded work, you know, which turns out to be Play, which, in, you know, ironically becomes your best-selling album of all time. But you're in a dark place when the book ends.
I thought there was something both perverse and kind of endearing about that, about like basically ending the book on the day that should have been the beginning of the book.
With Play and the Grammys and the success.
Yeah. And then hopefully that will become a second book. Because it's interesting because you were saying like, oh, well, the book ends right before the album Play comes out with the assumption that when Play came out, things got better. It's like, no, things got much worse. Like, do you remember the movie Gremlins?
Sure.
And how you're not supposed to like feed gremlins after midnight yeah. or they kind of metastasize into evil. Like, that's what happens in the second book mm-hmm. is like you take the insecurity, you know, you take all these issues and you feed them fame and attention and alcohol and drugs and money, and everything goes way darker.
Why does my heart feel so bad? Why does my soul feel so bad?
Moby did end up writing that second volume, called Then It Fell Apart, and it's available next month. After a short break, we'll continue our 2016 conversation with Moby about the enormous mainstream success of his 1999 album, Play. That's all coming up on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX. Why does my heart...
Rock, y'all, non-stop, y'all, to the beat. The body rock, y'all, so let's rock, y'all, non-stop, y'all, to the beat, y'all, the body rock, y'all, so let's rock, y'all, non-stop, y'all, to the beat, y'all.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Greg Kot. My partner is Jim DeRogatis, and that's a track called Body Rock from our guest this week, Moby. Now, that song was just one of many hits from his 1999 album, Play. And when we spoke with Moby in 2016, his first memoir, called Porcelain, had just come out. Now, Porcelain covers his career until right before Play was released. But we asked Moby to inch forward in time 6 months beyond where Porcelain ends. Here you have this strange electronic record built on samples of Alan Lomax's field recordings, and it surprises everyone. Play becomes a huge hit, mm-hmm. ends up selling 10 million copies. Where were you in your life when you realized, hey, people really like this, and it's starting to get commercial radio airplay, and all this stuff's happening with the record that nobody expected?
It was so baffling, because basically, before Play was released, I lost my record deal with Elektra. I still had my deal with Mute Records. Mm-hmm. We put out Play and just assumed it was going to fail. Like, everyone, we liked it. And people, everyone told me that, oh, this is a nice record. But it was the time of Limp Bizkit. It was the time of the Backstreet Boys.
Yeah. It was dark days.
Yeah. And I made this super weird lo-fi record in my bedroom involving voices that were 50 years old. Mm-hmm. Like, not a recipe for success. And then it kept getting more successful. And every time we got more successful, we thought that was it.
You can't get any bigger than this.
Yeah, we're like, wow, it sold 100,000 copies worldwide. And then 6 months later, it was selling 100,000 copies a week. And I couldn't believe it. Like, it was really, it felt like bizarre, almost psychedelic, magical alchemy, you know, that I had combined some old drum machines and synths and old vocals and somehow created this bizarre pop culture phenomena.
Get my honey, come back. Sometime I'm on a red back jack. Sometime I get a hump in my back. Sometime I'm going over here. Yeah. Sometime. Get my honey, come back. Sometime I'm on a red back jack. Sometime.
It just kept getting bigger and it kept getting bigger. And it was so much fun and I didn't want it to ever end. And by 2001, 2002, I was convinced that I'd found the key to happiness, which was staying on tour, staying famous, drinking as much as I could, taking as many drugs as I could, having as many one-night stands as I could, and just making sure that everybody on the planet loved me as much as they possibly could. So it seemed like a very sustainable approach to happiness and well-being.
But I remember talking to you during that period, and you seemed like the same normal Moby I'd met in 1991 when Go came out.
I mean, I guess to an extent I was, but deep down I had developed, I think, a level of like narcissistic entitlement that was really going off the rails. So like, the truth is, it was really fun. You know, like when Play was happening, 18 was happening, like touring constantly, drinking, doing drugs, dating all sorts of inappropriate people. Like, it was really fun.
Well, this is why most people enter the music business. You know?
And it was, all of a sudden, I was like, had movie stars on speed dial and was getting invited to crazy parties. And it was really fun. But every day that I was on the receiving end of all that intention, I just went more wrong. Along with depression, anxiety, alcoholism, drug addiction. And this is the challenging thing in trying to write the second book, is it's already been written. You know, the second book is this very conventional narrative of fame, money, alcohol, drugs, etc., and the sort of dissipation and despair that arises from that. But lots of people have written that book, so I have to figure out now how to write that in a way that has a unique quality to it.
Ooh, Lordy, my trouble so hard. Ooh, Lord, my trouble so hard. Don't nobody know my trouble but God. Don't nobody know my trouble but God.
You write in very close detail about the way you created some of this music, which I found fascinating.
Oh, yeah. Well, because a lot of the music that I write about in the book, the making of it, I still don't know how it got made, you know, which is... I know that's a cliche. Like, musicians will say, like, I don't know who wrote this song. I was just the conduit for it. And I don't know if I was a conduit, more like a bystander. Like, all of a sudden, there's this piece of music. And I was like, I don't know where it came from. So you can be both, like, the composer, the musician, but also the first audience member. And I think in writing about the making of these pieces of music, of course, I wanted to mention the technical side, but more I wanted to somehow show or share or represent the emotional side. You know, because ultimately that's why we like music. That's why we're sitting here, is because at an early age we all decided that music's magical ability to convey emotion is why we wanted to dedicate our lives to it. In other memoirs that I've read, when they just focus on the technical side or the historical context, I'm like, that's interesting, but how did you feel about it?
Well, I think you explain why people even endeavor to do this when all else feels lost. Like, I've got no reason to make this record other than the fact that it gives me this emotion that I can't feel anywhere else. And that, you know, very few people sort of address that very basic point But it seems to me like you would be making music whether people listen to it or not. It seems like there's a basic need within you to do that.
Well, especially now. My manager, who is German, and we've been working together for 25 years, the strength of our rapport, he just insults me. I don't like touring. I don't like DJing. I just want to be alone in my studio making music. And he just ridicules me. He's like, oh, so the middle-aged musician just wants to make records. He doesn't want to tour. Like, he's like, what's wrong with you? Like, go tour, make some money. But I just want to be left alone in my studio to work on music, because that's the enjoyable part.
Were you smart enough to put away all that money from play so that you don't have to worry about that? I mean, I know you live simply. You know, you'd be happy to go back to the early days descriptions of living, squatting in a warehouse with a bathroom down the hall. But did that put you in a good place forever?
Yeah. I mean, I do live a relatively simple life. Like, I live in L.A. I have a pretty simple house. I have a car. I don't really like nice things very much. Yeah. I have a blender that helps me make smoothies.
A really nice blender?
It's okay.
Okay.
It's a Breville. I got a table where I can sit and read books. Mm-hmm. I have a laptop, and I have a bedroom that has equipment in it to make music. I don't really need much more than that.
Yeah.
But the nice thing is, yeah, so some of the money from play I've saved and invested. And forgive me if this is crass, but I made one really good investment. The first tour I ever did was with the band The Shaman, British rave band. Yeah. And I was their opening act. This was 1992. And we drove from L.A. to Austin. And it was such a miserable drive. It was a 26-hour drive. And they took acid and smoked pot the entire way. And I was this sober non-smoker. So I sat in the back of the bus, like, listening to Nick Drake cassettes, just being sad. And we got to Austin. And I got off the bus, like, quivering with exhaustion and hunger. And I walked into the hotel that we had. And I walked up to the concierge and I said, I'm so hungry. Is there anywhere around here where I can get vegan food? And he said, oh, there's this local health food store called Whole Foods. It's around the corner. And I walked into Whole Foods and it was so beautiful and wonderful. And I called my accountant and I said, there's this company called Whole Foods in Texas. Are they a publicly traded company? And he said, actually, they've just been listed. So I bought some Whole Foods stock. And so that's one of the things that helps me to not
brilliant.
Tour.
That is brilliant.
So veganism led me to not having to tour that much.
Rave, for lack of a better word, scene today, EDM, if we want to use the buzz phrase.
Sure.
When you have—
By the way, I used EDM seriously recently, and I was almost crucified for it. Apparently, EDM has become this bad acronym.
Yeah, we're already past it. Yeah.
But I kind of love it because it's the most reductionist acronymic description of music.
Yeah.
Like, just imagine if rock music had been called, like, electric guitar music.
Yeah.
If jazz was called saxophone piano music.
You know, we have these giant super raves. We have these superstar, you know, something weird about seeing these dance parties that once were organic, independent, underground, bacchanals, now brought to you in Soldier Field here in Chicago. We have one in Soldier Field.
I've played at it.
You know, it's
like
insane.
I'm a sober 50-year-old. I'm kind of not allowed to have an opinion. You know, in a way, like I'm not the target demographic. So, like, that's my qualification for that. But also, on one hand, I fully understand the success of it. Because if you take a 19-year-old kid and put him or her in a field with 50,000 other 19-year-olds all scantily clad and potentially taking Class A narcotics and give them Cirque du Soleil-style crazy pyrotechnics and visuals and flawlessly produced electronic music, of course they're going to have a powerful experience.
Don't let me down. Don't let me down, down, down.
It is fascinating that this is the current manifestation of what started with like a couple of turntables in a warehouse on the edge of town.
Right. Or even, in a field here.
Yeah, or even going further back, what started in the African-American Latino gay community
right.
in the 80s. There's one aspect of it, and I'm going to sound like a cranky old guy, is that all the DJs now have to play top 40 records. Like that's the thing that breaks my heart the most is that when we were all young people going to these events, the DJs were playing underground records that were hits in this scene, but outside of the scene, no one knew about
right.
them.
Mm-hmm.
And the last time I played one of these big events, and this is one of the reasons why I have a really hard time going back, is the DJs all play Katy Perry remixes.
Mm.
It kind of breaks my heart. Like it would be the equivalent of like going to see the Rolling Stones and like
right.
in the middle of their set, the Rolling Stones have to play like a John Mayer song. One of the most remarkable things about the punk rock world, about the hip hop world, about the early house music and dance music worlds is everything was being invented every day. You know, like you think of the rave scene, it's like you had all these 20-year-olds figuring out how to cobble together equipment to make records. And then, well, they had their recording. Yeah. So then they have to figure out how to press it on vinyl and how to ship it around the world. And then they were opening record stores and starting clothing companies, learning how to be promoters. So it's a very overused acronym, DIY,
mm-hmm.
but every part of it was DIY. And there was also a sonic novelty.
Right. Mm-hmm.
You know, so it might be borrowing bits and pieces from industrial music or funk music or whatever, but it was a musical vernacular that was being spontaneously, collectively invented.
Mm.
And to an extent, I think we almost took it for granted. We're like, this is great, but we didn't have a basis of comparison, so we didn't know right. that was kind of going to be the end of the newness of it.
You know, you write with so much heart and soul and insight about the music you fell in love with, whether it's Bad Brains or whether it's Frankie Knuckles or whether it's black disco and house music. Mm-hmm. And obviously you felt that way about the Alan Lomax samples that made play so magical. And I think that's the thing that's immortal. You know, how they sell it is irrelevant.
Mm-hmm.
Are people still forming their identities and having their lives changed by music?
I hope so. So I got to work with Oliver Sacks.
Yeah, we had him as a guest on the show.
So he started an organization called the Institute for Music and Neurologic Function.
Mm-hmm.
And they actually look at how music affects the brain and the endocrine system and how it affects us. And I've been working with that organization for a long time. The thing that struck me after working with them is like, music changes people. Like it really does, not mm-hmm. just anecdotally, but it actually alters neurochemistry. It promotes neurogenesis. It decreases stress hormones. It promotes growth hormones. Like it's this magic pill
mm-hmm.
and it doesn't exist. Like music technically
right.
doesn't exist.
It's ethereal. It's in the
air. It's just these weird air molecules, nitrogen and oxygen, hitting our eardrum a little differently.
Mm-hmm.
So like, if someone has like a jackhammer or if Yo-Yo Ma is playing a cello, they're technically making the same thing. They're pushing air molecules.
Right.
Except one makes you want to weep and the other just annoys you.
Right.
So it really is like that power of music, which is ineffable and so baffling that it will make people like cut their hair, move across mm-hmm. country, like change their career, ditch a college education, have sex, dance, march into war, baptize a child. Like music is involved in all these things and it's just air molecules. And that's why we're sitting here. It's because yeah. it has affected us so profoundly so many times and it keeps affecting us. It's that subtext of like, what's going on? How is it
right.
that this thing that really doesn't seem to confer any survival benefit. Like there's no evolutionary benefit to music that we can see, but yet it makes us cry and dance and do all these crazy things.
Yeah.
It seems like a very worthwhile pursuit, you know?
That was beautiful. I don't know why we even bother to write anymore, Greg. I mean, it's more that we knew we were never going to make play and sell 10 million records, but I mean, at least we had this writing thing down.
So pleased to have Moby as our guest on Sound Opinions once again. Thanks so much for coming in, man.
Oh, I love coming here.
Now we want to hear from you. What do you think about music's power over the mind? What are your memories of the early rave scene? Give us a call on our hotline, 888-859-1800. When we return, we'll review the new album from Intellectual, a project of two Chance the Rapper collaborators, and Greg will drop a quarter into the Desert Island Jukebox. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX. Welcome back to Sound Opinions. That is a little bit of the track Pop Star, the lead track on the new album Intellectual by Nate Fox and Nico Siegel. Who are these guys, Greg? They first made a big splash as part of the social experiment known as Chance the Rapper's backing band. They had been kicking around the Chicago hip-hop scene for some time. Fox and Siegel have now relocated to Los Angeles. I have read several critics who I trust comparing them to a Chicago version of The Roots in terms of really talented producers and musicians working with a wide array of artists. In Nico Siegel, formerly Donnie Trumpet's case, he's worked with Kanye West, Ed Sheeran, J. Cole, and even Neil Young. Nate Fox has worked with Dram, Kalani, Big Sean, and Lil Wayne. Now they've come together for a follow-up to the social experiment album Surf that is quite different. Intellectual is the name of the record. We're going to play a track, Like I Feel, by Nate Fox and Nico Siegel, and we'll come back and give our reviews on Sound Opinions.
That is Like I Feel, one of the tracks from the new Intellectual album, a debut album from a group called Intellectual, with Nico Siegel and Nate Fox in this mushrooming collective built yes. around Chance the Rapper. Multi-projects coming out of that. This is the latest one of those.
Chance being one of the few people who don't appear on this record.
Yeah, Chance is actually not on this record.
Because Vic Mensa, Esperanza Spalling, there's a lot of guests.
Just about everybody else is. And that's the approach that this collective has taken on its records, bringing together a community of musicians. It's multi-hyphenate music. It is like, you know, you can't pin it down. What is it exactly? Well, it's many things. It's hip-hop, it's gospel, it's jazz, it's soul, it's rock, it's avant-garde, it's experimental, it's pop. I love the fact that a lot of this record for me occupies that space between traditional songcraft and something more experimental, more atmospheric. You know, a track like Boca, which has Esperanza Spalding on bass.
Boca fechada, não se alimenta.
Thank you. What is that exactly? It's got those creeping bass lines. It's got that Latin percussion. It's got those distant voices, like, you know, a choir going on in the background. There's horns darting in and out. And then at the end, you've got this incredible synth line. I think Peter Cottontail, another one of the social experiment players, is playing it. And it's just going out into the galaxy, and you go, okay, it's taking me into a completely different area here in its coda. It's taking you on this little mini trip. You know, I'm thinking about a track like Pop Star, which we played at the top. That's an attempt, I think, to compress all the different styles of Chicago music that have been occupying this scene here for the last decade or so into like a 3.5 minute track. I mean, you've got everything from DJ Spin doing some footwork rhythms to some jazz trumpet from Nico Siegel. To some classical strings, to some gospel, and you know, it's this, you know, collage of all these different styles of music, and yet there is still a recognizable pop sensibility at the core of it. I think this is a really wonderful record. It takes you all over the place, and yet it's very much rooted in the idea that there are melodies here and that these are crafted songs that can be digested very easily instead of like making you work really hard to enjoy them. Just sit back and bask in it.
You know, Fox and Siegel have made the point that they set out to write songs very self-consciously that were like James Taylor, Carole King, and Carly Simon.
Right.
And I don't think they were kidding. You know what this album reminds me of is Commons' Electric Circus, a record that, that really is singular in his catalog. Classic rock in this city is also inescapable. So, you know, Common was talking about how much he loved Pink Floyd.
Right.
And you have Nate and Nico talking about their deep and absolutely sincere, I believe, love for James Taylor.
I was trying to take my rest.
But then it gets put into this genre-defying, eccentric blender, and it just is brilliant. You know, and all of those hyphenates make it sound like it's work to listen to.
No, it's not.
It's not. It's a complete joyride.
Came in as a rock star. With an entourage, but I'm leaving as a monologue. I've been working every day just to be a better man.
I tell you, little buddy, this whole island is bewitched.
You remember, we were shipwrecked together.
Stranded, I'm so far from home. Stranded, yeah, I'm on my own. Stranded, you gotta leave me alone. Cause I'm stranded on my own. Stranded, far from home.
As often as possible here on Sound Opinions, one of us takes a trip to the desert island, pops a quarter in the jukebox, and plays you a song we can't live without. Greg, it is your turn.
Jim, I want to pay tribute to one of the most intriguing, perhaps most misunderstood figures in popular music of the last half century. I mean, it sounds like a big deal, right? Scott Walker. He died at age 76 on March 22nd. You know, I was just talking to the guys in Sun, that dark metal group, a few weeks ago.
Drone Masters.
And they were telling me about the time they worked with Scott Walker on a collaborative album. If you could ever think about two exact opposites working together and coming up with something cool, that might be it. Scott Walker, this who was a teen pop idol in the 60s working with a group called the Walker Brothers. They had a big hit called The Sun Ain't Gonna Shine Anymore. Yep. Working with these masters of this deep, dark form of metal music. And they said the guy was amazing. He was in his 70s already and still curious, still working with new sounds. You know, his career had shifted over those 50 years into a deeper, darker, more experimental place. In fact, I played one of his tracks, a track called Jesse, which conflates the death of Elvis Presley's twin brother in the womb and 9/11 one of the most strange, horrifying pieces of atmospheric music that I've ever heard.
You know, throw into that, you're neglecting to say that he moved further away from that white soul, northern soul kind of English thing of his early days toward like pure opera.
Yeah, no, he was, he had a tremendous voice, he had a tremendous feel for classical orchestration, and at the same time, there was this pop sensibility at work. People revered different phases of his career for different reasons. I think there are three distinct ones. That pop phase at the very start, then he moves away from it in the middle period with what are now called the Scott albums by his fans. Four albums, you know, self-titled, you know, Scott 1, Scott 2, Scott 3, Scott 4, and then the deep, dark experimental stuff that occupied much of his 90s and 2000s. I want to focus on that middle period, that those orc pop records that he made in the late 60s, the Scott albums, which are wonderful, strange, eccentric, still a pop sensibility, but classical orchestrations working in it, not conventional listening by any stretch. The song I want to play is from Scott 4, which I consider the best of those Scott records. It's completely original songwriting on that record. The song is The Seventh Seal. It kicks off the album. It's basically a condensation of the plot line in the Ingmar Bergman movie classic. You know, death pays a visit to this medieval knight, and they're playing a game of chess, and your life is over, medieval knight, and they said, well, you know, I'm gonna fight to the end, I'm going to win this chess match, and of course, you know, we know how that turns out.
Yeah, you don't beat death.
No, you don't beat death. But at the same time, a very ambitious movie and an incredibly ambitious pop song from Scott Walker, The Seventh Seal from Scott Walker on Sound of the Pages.
This morning I played chess with death, said the knight. We played that he might grant me time. My bishop and my knights will shatter his flanks, and still I might feel God's heart in mine. And through confession's grill, death's laughter was heard. The knight cried, no, you've cheated me. But still I'll find a way, we'll meet once again, and once again continue to play. They met within the woods, the knight, his squire and friends, and death said, now the game shall end. The final move was made, the knight hung his head and said, you've won, I've nothing left to play. The minstrel, filled with visions, sang to his love to look against the stormy sky. The knight, his squire and friends, their hands held as one, solemnly danced towards the dawn. His hourglass in his hand, his sight by his side, the master death, he leads them on. The rain will wash away the tears from their faces, and as the thunder cracked, they were gone.
That is the Seventh Seal, a scary, kind of a, you know,
yeah.
It haunts me when I listen to the end of that song, which we just played from Scott Walker, dead at the age of 76 on March 22nd.
I've spent a lot of time trying to figure Scott Walker out, yeah. And I don't think I'm there yet, but maybe someday when I grow up. What do we have on the show next week, Greg?
Jim, next week we're going to mark the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 moon landing and play some songs about outer space.
Ground control to Major Tom. Ground control to Major Tom. Take your protein pills and put your helmet on. Ground control to Major Tom.
Sounds like fun. We're taking off in the rocket. Greg, people can get Sound Opinions wherever they get their podcast thingies. The show is produced, as always, by Brendan Banasak, Alex Claiborne, Ayanna Contreras, and Andrew Gill.
I got two phones, one for the plug and one for the load. I got two phones, one for the and one for the dough.
On Sound Opinions, everyone's a critic. So give us a call on our hotline,
888-859-1800. New messages.
My name's Nikki. I'm calling from Chicago. I'm calling about last episode on the shoegazer scene, which I thought was super cool. You talked about the ride, and I have to say my favorite song on that wonderful album that you mentioned is Today. Such tragic lyrics. And then this crescendo, this great, pretty sad ending, but also sweet and lovely. Great show. Love what you guys do, as always. Bye.
Hey, I was just listening to Sound Opinions, the Rock Doctor part. I'm with Adam. And I think I have a perfect record for him by Dan Mangan called More or Less.
Now the keeps in, now the valleys, and I've been down some, but I'll rally.
A lot of songs deal with whether or not he can remain relevant, if he's too old to be cool, and then just some songs on how to best deal with issues that you face in life, especially when getting older, such as just fear and peaks and valleys.
So is it simple being older? We got all these kids upon our shoulders. See, I just get softer. The world gets colder. Now I'm twisted up and lost in thought. But do you remember?
And I think it's going to be perfect for Adam. My name is Monica. I'm calling from a parking lot in Tulsa, Oklahoma, where I just drove to from L.A. on my way home to Brooklyn, New York. All right. Thank you. Bye.
Hey, this is Tracy. I'm calling from Lakeview. I wanted to call and add a song recommendation for Adam. In the same year, I lost my mom and went through a divorce, and it was by far the worst year of my life. And the album that brought me the most comfort was Beck's Morning Phase.
Woke up this morning.
It's, you know, an album about waking up in the morning, but, you know, to me it brought comfort as the morning being better times and a time when I wouldn't feel this way again. It just meant a lot to me, and I hope it connects with him too. Thanks.
Hi. I listen to your guys' podcast all the time, and I hadn't heard you talk about a guy who goes under the name of Phil Woozy.
You never leave my mind. Why would you have to?
I've been super into him lately. He doesn't have a full album yet, but he's phenomenal. My name is Trace. I'm from Las Vegas, Nevada. Thanks.
To die, but you know I love it when you hit the end and run around yelling. That's when I'm melting. It always happens so fast, just like that.
No more messages.
To give us your opinions on Sound Opinions, call our hotline 888-859-1800. We'll be back next week with more Sound Opinions, produced by WBEZ Chicago and distributed by PRX.
I just wanna get a rise from you, and that's what I do, yeah.